That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome back to That Money Show on FUBAR Radio. I am your host for the next hour or so, Gabriel, aka That Money Guy. You should know that by now, unless you're completely new to the show, in which case I should probably let you know what's coming up and how we're going to make you better with your money, like I said, in roughly 60 minutes. That's a promise and a guarantee with my stamp of approval on it. So every single week on That Money Show, we do a few things. Firstly, we like to break down the relevant news going on in the economy that actually affect your personal finances. None of the fluff, nothing going on outside, none of the noise, none of the negativity, sometimes negativity actually when it comes to personal finance. But overall, we're actually trying to give you useful and tangible news. And then of course, we like to bring in some guests because you guys get bored of me. And we like to hear from a range of experts, famous people and general personal finance experts to hear their advice, their tips and their stories. And this week we've got two incredible guests. Yet again, we've got Danielle Tomlinson, an artist and also a former Team GB swimmer. That's pretty cool. And also Dr. Dion Terrelonge, the fashion psychologist. Interesting, but I'm going to leave it there just to kind of really make sure that you're staying on top of your form and you're kind of going to stick around, because I feel like that title is quite interesting, but I don't want to explain too much about it just yet. But like promised, let's start off with the news. Last week, I went, the news, like Jeremy Clarkson used to do on Top Gear, and I didn't know if I was going to get copyrighted. We didn't get an email from any of his producers, so I'm going to stick with saying that, which is absolutely fine. But I've actually got Amy Knight, the writer at NerdWallet UK, sat opposite me to help me break down the news. So how are you doing, Amy?
Good, thank you. Thanks for having me back.
Absolute pleasure. What do you think of my the news? Did that ring any references? Didn't watch Top Gear?
I would like to say that I was a Top Gear fan, but I feel like recent un-PC associations, maybe I'll just leave it there.
Do I have to rewind everything? Am I about to get cancelled live on air for saying that? It's fine. It's been a good run. Anyway, what's going on in the news right now? I feel like the first story that we wanted to discuss today is about the price cap on energy bills going up. Now, ordinarily, this would be negative news, but we're still lower than we were a year ago. But then again, to kind of like play devil's advocate, but then play angel again, but then play devil's advocate, last year they were really, really high. So going up isn't the best news that people want to hear. Why is this happening in the first place?
Yeah, I was really looking forward to finding the silver lining and saying, oh, well, it's not gone up as much as we thought it was going to. But actually, the prediction was 9% and ended up being 10%.
Yay.
So it's really down to the wholesale prices of energy. And the price cap is there to protect consumers so that the volatility in the energy market, we're not feeling the full force of those ups and downs. So this latest increase is to try and bring some of that wholesale price fluctuation back in line with what consumers are paying without giving people a huge shock in their bill.
Got it. So according to the statistics, we will be seeing an average rise of £149 in October when this new price cap comes into effect, which says people using an average amount of 1,717 will see that kind of 10% rise overall. But more importantly, and probably the hardest hit people with this new price cap rise, well, just generally, are going to be pensioners. The new Labour reforms expected to come into play pretty much soon is the idea that 10 million pensioners are no longer going to get their winter fuel allowance. That doesn't sound ideal.
Yeah, this has definitely come to as a bit of a shock. And it's what it means is that pensioners who are in receipt of pension credit are automatically going to get those fuel payments, but other pensioners may not be eligible. And I think the new government is going to be tightening up eligibility criteria for different benefits across the board. So it is worth just checking, going on the government website and checking what you're entitled to, making sure you're claiming what you can get and adjusting your budget if you've been receiving some support that you're not going to get anymore.
Yeah, I feel like if this is a real kind of CTA moment on the show where there are so many people that are eligible for benefits that they just don't go claimed. I think there's literally billions within the economy every single year that go unclaimed by people. So if you have elderly relatives or your parents or someone of pension age that you know, just get them to check that they aren't eligible in the first place, because you never know if they are. That's going to be a huge amount of money saved. We're talking probably somewhere in the region of £1,500 obviously depending on the size of your property and all that kind of stuff, but what, £1,700 on average a year, that could be some considerable savings, especially to, you know, someone that's no longer working, bringing in an income and all of that kind of stuff. So make sure you're on it, because otherwise, like we said, this allowance is being withdrawn by the Labour government. You are going to start to see these kind of decisions being made as Rachel Reeves, you know, apparently tries to firmly take control of the economy. But now onto a more fun news story, in my opinion. You guys probably weren't expecting this to be the news story today, but Tesco meal deals are going up. I'm gutted. I'm a Tesco meal deal enthusiast, loyalist. It's my weekly lunch. I can go through my order, but that probably would bore everyone. But they're going up. They are currently £3.40. Don't even have to look at my notes for this one, because I'm so ingrained within their system. But £3.40 going up to £3.60. Not life-changing, but also not great, because some people do rely on these pretty much every single day. Again, any idea why they're doing this in the first place?
They've tried to justify it, saying that they're improving the selection, the variety, the quality. I think I read that they're making the cheddar cheese more mature. So whether or not you can justify paying an extra 20p for slightly stronger cheese, I'm not sure.
I don't know why in my head someone making cheddar cheese more mature is like sitting it down in a room and educating it like a lump of cheese. That's in my head. Okay, the cheddar cheese will be more mature. I don't go for the cheese, so that won't affect me. I also assume they'll be mildly improving their baseline and their profits that they take from this.
Yeah, I mean, behind all of this is inflation, which is a story that's been bubbling away. We've spoken about it before. The cost of ingredients, the cost of packaging, the wages that Tesco have to pay its staff, everything's going up. And so at some point, they have to pass a portion of that on to the consumer.
Yeah. And I should note, by the way, when I said it's going for £3.40 to £3.60, that's if you use a club card, which I do believe 80% of people that get the meal deals do. But for the other 20%, we're going from what was it? It's also going up from £3.90 to £4.
That's
or something
it.
Like that.
And that differential really struck out to me, because the actual increase, it's still cheaper if you have a club card than if you don't, but the actual increase is more for the loyal club card customer. A club card holder will pay 20 pence more for their meal deal. Mm-hmm. The non-club card holder has only got a 10% increase. So that seems a little
fuming.
Bit. Yeah, there may,
punishing
there
us for
may
being
be
loyal.
Some disgruntled club card holders. I would definitely say it's still worth signing up to the loyalty schemes for whichever supermarkets you use. I keep all of mine in my Apple Wallet, so it doesn't matter whether I'm going to Sainsbury's, Tesco, wherever. I can always get the lower prices that you benefit from when you're a loyalty card holder.
Yeah, I think that's a real must, like if you're talking about personal finance advice, to have every single card available on your phone, because let's be honest, we all leave our cards at home these days, and have all of the ones that you could ever possibly go to. I mean, if you're never going to go to a Morrison's, like, and if they, I don't even know if they've got a loyalty card, but you don't need that, obviously. However, the ones that you do regularly go to, I would recommend getting on the scheme. Even if you're fully against the concept of loyalty, why are you paying more money just to be resistant? It's not going to change. It's worth, you know, like I said, going with the flow and going with everything. But I think one thing we did want to discuss in the first place was a very simple question. Is the Tesco meal deal even worth it?
This boils down to what matters most to you. If convenience is your highest priority, then sure, meal deals are going to save you time. It means that you can grab lunch on the go, wherever you're going, whatever your work situation is. If keeping to a tight budget is your number one priority, then no. Sadly, a meal deal is never going to be as cheap as making your lunch at home, buying the bread separately, buying the butter, buying whatever filling. And I was doing some maths earlier and looked up the average price of a loaf of bread in the UK, currently 88 pence. Mm-hmm. And you can get normally about 18 slices out of a loaf. So that's 9 sandwiches.
Hey.
So, okay, I've not factored in the butter and the filling there.
Got it.
If you'd said less than 10p per sandwich just on the bread, the saving, if you're willing to put in the time and be that bit more organised, not everybody's able to do that. The other point to note on meal deals is that they can sometimes tempt you to buy more and spend more than you actually meant to. So if you're going to a shop such as Tesco and all you actually need is a sandwich, but you get tempted into buying the drink and the crisps as well. If the sandwich was £2.50 approximately, you're going to then spend £4 on a meal deal. instead of the £2.50. And there's this phrase called spaving.
Yeah. You told that to me just before we came on air. And yeah. I was like, spaving? What's spaving? So but then you explained it.
Spending and kidding yourself that you're saving. And this happens when there's multi-buy offers.
I was going to say, let's go through some case studies of spaving. So I'm in a shop. I want an avocado, but they're 3 for 2. Do I get 3 for 2?
If you're going to use them, that's fine. But if you really only need one and you've only budgeted for one, just buy the one.
Or a classic, buy one, get the next one 50% off, right? Yeah. That's if Absolutely. I only needed one.
And the worst kind of spaving is online, okay. where it says, spend an extra £22 to get free delivery.
That costs £1.99.
Yeah, and you didn't need that other thing.
Got it. I am cheeky sometimes, and if it's free returns, I will order the free delivery so I don't have to pay delivery and then return the thing I didn't want to. Am I allowed to say that?
Quite a lot of retailers are starting to charge for returns though, so watch out.
Okay. I need to keep an eye on that. Yeah. That's a tactic that's going out the window. I might just have to, you know, actually fork out for delivery. I'm so against paying for delivery. I feel like it's in my soul. I'm not willing to do it whatsoever. Even like when I didn't have a Prime account, do you remember back in the day you had to get like £20 worth of orders? If I needed something, I would wait until I had £20 in my basket before hitting buy. Obviously with Prime, that's not even a conversation worth considering anymore. But spaving, that's important. Lock that one down in your brain and absolutely memorize it. And I love that you did the maths on the sandwich cost, because I'm also like thinking, because you said it's to do with the finances, but it's also to do with time, because a time is a reason why people might be willing to, you know, spend a little bit more. But let's say you walk 5 minutes to your Tesco, you spend about 5 minutes in there picking what you're going to get, and 5 minutes back to the office. It doesn't take 15 minutes to make a sandwich at home. So are you just kidding yourself into thinking you're saving time?
I'm not going to be smug about this, because I bought 2 meal deals on Tuesday. Not both for myself.
Lunch
for
and
my
second
children.
Lunch?
Yeah, okay. I had a day off with my children. I was taking them for a picnic. And then I found that the teenager had eaten all the bread. So there was nothing to make sandwiches. And I did not have the time to go to the shop to get the ingredients to make the sandwich. And some people are so time poor. Mm. The pressures of modern life, working, juggling families. In reality, you can't always do what might be the best financial move.
All right. I want 2 more questions I want to ask. Number one is, are meal deals, are they actually, how much are they actually saving you? Do you know roughly what the savings are?
Yeah, the Tesco meal deal, I did look at this. I put the triple sandwich, the McCoy's steak crisps, which are the most popular variety, and a can of Coke in my online shopping basket, and that came to £6.15. So even if you didn't have a club card and you spent £4 on your meal deal, you've saved a couple of quid there.
Okay, so it's definitely still technically a saving. I wouldn't get any of those things. Salt and vinegar and regular Coke out the window for me. I'm a Diet Coke or a Coke Zero all the way. And then, well, my second question was going to be, what's your Tesco meal deal order? Tesco are getting a big shout out here, by the way. General meal deal order.
Yeah, I use other supermarkets just as much. Mine is an egg and cress on wholemeal.
Love it.
Crisps, anything crinkly. It's got to
crinkle
be a crinkly
cut.
Crisp for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And quite like an iced tea.
Love it. There you go. That's the personal finance knowledge you wanted on your Monday. There we go. Amy, thank you so much for joining us in the studio. Really useful as always. And always worth checking out NerdWallet as well for some good personal finance expertise. Is that right?
Absolutely. Whether you're looking for a mortgage, a business bank account, we've got all sorts of pages to help you make that decision a bit easier.
There you go. Well, thank you very much. And stick around, because straight after the break, we're going to be joined by Danielle Tomlinson. Like I said, an artist, but a former Team GB swimmer. We'll catch you then.
FUBAR Radio.
Making personal finance simpler with Gabriel Nussbaum. This is That Money Show.
Well, hello and welcome back to That Money Show with me, Gabriel, That Money Guy. We are live on FUBAR Radio, for those of you that just joined us. If you have just joined us, we've just had a really great conversation that you might have missed about Tesco meal deals. Go and listen to it. It was a fun one, I promise you. But anyway, stick around, because right now I have Danielle Tomlinson, an artist and former Team GB swimmer, live in the studio to have a chat about, well, her journey from a GB swimmer to an artist and building a business around her passion. Anyway, Danielle, welcome to That Money Show. What I do want to ask, and what I think kind of the person listening will find really interesting, I mean, forget the person listening, even me will find really interesting, is obviously you were competing within a sport at a really high level. And that's, I mean, has to have affected your personality, your competitive drive, you know, your the way that you grew up, all that kind of stuff. So kind of that's probably just been instilled in as part of you and who you are today. Have you seen that kind of the positive things that you took from being an athlete transfer itself into the way that you've built a business?
Oh, for sure. I mean, even when I talk to my friends who are like employers, they hold athletes so highly when they apply for jobs, just because you learn so much sort of like resilience, motivation, and also a lot of like, you know, self-responsibility. Like everything you do, you can probably blame yourself for. And I'm quite goal orientated as well. And I think that helps running any business, just to have sort of like short-term, medium and long-term goals and a plan to get there. So yeah, going into an art career, obviously a notoriously really hard sort of area to be in. Yeah, it's aided me really, really well. So
fair enough. Have you ever kind of like utilized that kind of athlete, you know, GB swimmer to help the business progress? Has it helped in any way, shape or form? Or is it its own entity in and of itself?
So in regards to sort of like contacts and stuff, it's been absolutely useless.
Swimmers don't want paintings. Yeah. The
no,
bastards.
They've got better things to spend their money on. But yeah, so I've just kind of used like the qualities and attributes that I've gained in order to like run a business. And thankfully, it's been really transferable. But yeah, in regards to sort of like contacts and just being in the swimming world, it's been pretty useless.
Shocking. So annoying. All those years of swimming to lead up to the art business and they couldn't help you whatsoever. It is what it is. But I do kind of want to now focus on the business itself, because that's like you said, that's what you've been doing for the past 4 years. That's what your passion is. That's what you've clearly been doing this morning as well. How have you found, you know, building something from scratch, especially something that was your hobby, and turning it into a full-time business? Obviously not all like positives and rainbows and daffodils and all that kind of stuff all the time, but overall, is this one of the best decisions you ever made?
Oh, for sure. I think like work-life balance is like amazing, as in like I feel like you should always, is what's the saying, it's you work to live, you don't live to work. And being your own boss, you definitely have like a lot of flexibility on your day and when you start and when you finish. And as long as you get all your jobs done and, you know, you're still ticking off everything you need to, it's been really great. So I'd say that's definitely sort of like a massive positive of doing it. And also, I just love what I do. Like if you're like a musician or if you're an actor or anything, even if you love numbers, as long as you love what you do, it never feels like a job. And I think that's definitely helped as well, because like I'm just really happy most of the time.
That's so nice to hear and so refreshing, because I feel like most people within their careers can't say that most of the time, you know, they're beaming when it comes to their job. So it's lovely to hear that, and it's evident that you've really kind of utilized that passion and turned it into an incredible business. But let's talk about the negatives, because I feel like they are just as important to share and speak about. What are some of those obstacles you've had to face and overcome along the way?
Definitely like loneliness, and I'm not here asking for like sympathy, but when you're sort of quite extroverted and you've been used to, even though swimming's an individual sport, like you've been used to being in a team environment, and I've never had a proper job, quote unquote. I've always ever done like did this straight out of uni. Kind of figuring out how to not be completely drained after sort of a day working on your own without talking to a single soul. Yeah, has definitely been a challenge. But, you know, I've been doing it 4 years now, so I've got things in place that help. But I found that most artists do actually struggle with loneliness if they are naturally quite extroverted. And I just say like learning how to like market yourself and actually figuring out like the nitty gritty of why you do what you do. And yeah, trying to like get that across on social media, because, you know, personal brand is everything. And I try and be as genuine and as authentic as I can, because, you know, you can only keep it up for so long if you're
the facade.
So I definitely say sort of like really figuring out why and not being like, so currently I'm painting like a series of dinosaurs, and I've absolutely loved dinosaurs and I kept it quiet for so long. And I was like, do you know what? Like, there's going to be other like adults who like dinosaurs. And do you know what? It's been great. So just being authentic and genuine, people really like connect with that. And actually, dinosaurs aren't as lame as what I actually thought they were.
Dinosaurs aren't lame at all. They're the biggest, scariest, most aggressive of all the animals. So that arguably puts them at the top of the pecking order when it comes to cool animals. I sound like a proper nerd right now. This is That Money Show, so we do have to talk money. It's an important topic, especially as a business owner. What are kind of the key, I suppose, financial habits that you've had to learn running a business to make sure that essentially it's sustainable? You're doing it for 4 years, so it is sustainable. But yeah, what's been the biggest shocks to you and surprises that you've managed to kind of learn along the way?
Yeah, I'd definitely say like margins. Like when you first start, like any artist, you kind of don't really have much money, and just keeping those margins, like only buying what you need until you sell it, in regards to like materials and stuff, was a big learning curve, and not overspending in that aspect, and like praying that you're going to sell sort of a couple of pieces in a month, because the thing with art, like you just never know like when things are going to sell. So not having like just loads of materials and no sales is like super important. And I definitely say, like, I'm not great with numbers, and knowing your strengths and weaknesses, and hiring a really good accountant, just to, you know, like, I'm hands up, I don't know, like I'm good at art, I'm not good at numbers, I'm good at swimming, I'm not good at like anything like that. So yeah, getting like the correct advice, and like taxes, like as anyone, it's hard when you're self-employed and you've got to do it all yourself. So
yeah, I mean, yeah. I'll be transparent myself as well. When it comes to running my own business, I love numbers. I am a maths nerd. That was all I studied throughout kind of my entire education system. I still hire an accountant to do taxes because I'm not willing to make that mistake. I feel like some people are very proud and they want to like take everything on, you know, themselves. But the truth is, the assistance that you can get and should get is, that's a really like invaluable piece of advice that you've just given to someone that's probably been holding on to a little bit too much. Like that self-assessment form, probably worth getting some help with it.
Yeah, for sure. And I just think, like, if your skills are better placed elsewhere, really sort of, you know, divide your time wisely. And actually, a really good accountant is worth every book that you spend on them. Mm. So yeah, that would be my advice.
Fair enough. So how is the business doing today? Obviously, you started it from scratch as a hobby. You're probably bricking it, trying to sell your first piece, like when you turn this into a full-fledged business, aside from, like you said, the little side hustle you were doing at uni. How was that moment selling your first piece officially from this business, and like how has the journey continued 4 years down the line?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I gave myself a bit of a deadline as soon as I started, and I decided I was gonna, you know, make this a business, and within 3 months I was like earning a full-time income. So it turned over pretty quickly, and that first sale I made, like that sort of like joy, I get that every single time I sell like a piece still, which is lovely. And especially like seeing them in their homes and like having them admired years later, I get like pictures from 4 years ago of people enjoying my artwork when I first started, which is really lovely. And, you know, actually having now the more time to do what I really love doing. So like painting dinosaurs, like to pay homage to sort of like the extinct animals, and more, you know, what our endangered animals could be like, and then helping out more with sort of animal charities like Tusk and WWF, like that's been lovely, and actually be able to have like the flexibility to do that. Whereas when I first started, I was mainly painting pets just to, like, you know, bread and butter, actually make sort of like get the ball rolling, and now I can actually do what I'm passionate about. So yeah, like 4 years, it seems like a blink, it's gone by so quickly. But yeah, I love it, it's great.
That's wicked. I mean, one thing I need to like learn from you is, you've clearly, you seem just as excited probably as the day you started when it comes to kind of doing this as your business. A lot of people say that you shouldn't try to monetize your passions, because the moment you rely on bringing in an income from what you love doing, you start to fall out of love with it. Have you ever experienced that? I mean, it doesn't look like you have now, because the kind of follow-up question is, how have you kept that energy level so high, that love and passion so high when it is your job?
Yeah, like I think like everyone, like when you do something, especially when you're doing a hobby, like your passion as a job, a jobby or whatever you people want to call it, it's really, you have to be really mindful of burnout. And like you think, oh, I love doing it, like I'm never going to get burnt out. You do, just as if you overtrained in the gym, like you know, you do genuinely get burnt out. So now I learn, instead of getting to point of like absolute stress and like burnout, especially around Christmas, just actually take breaks away from the studio, even when I don't want to. And yeah, I do that a couple of times a year, and I try and get away and like source inspiration elsewhere and, you know, abroad and stuff when I can. But yeah, taking breaks, even when I don't want to, just to make sure, you know, that the boiling water isn't sort of like going over the pan. Yeah, I'd say that.
I mean, there's a reason why bosses, even if you love your job, make you force you to take your annual leave, and you need to kind of force yourself to take your own annual leave. So even if it's less than the average person, that's great. Danielle, thank you so much for joining us on That Money Show. This has been a brilliant conversation. I don't know if there's anything you want to shout out. Where can people find your art, maybe, if they want to buy a piece, maybe that lion in the background?
Yeah, for sure. I'd say my Instagram, it's just Danielle Tomlinson Art, and you'll find me on there.
There we go. Go check it out if you're interested in dinosaur paintings, coming soon. Love it. All right, well, thank you so much for joining That Money Show, and I will be sure to check out more of your art very soon.
Cool, thanks for having me.
Bye. All right, that was wicked. I actually really want to buy that lion in the background. It was a lion, right? Sometimes I get mixed up between lions and tigers, and I feel like I'm being silly, but you know what? At the ripe age of 27, I think it was a lion. Okay, I always like to give you guys a money tip every single week. Something short, something practical, something concise that you can go and do. I normally say right now, but I need to change that. The moment this show is over, you can take note of it now, but then you can go and do it, and that will actually make you better with money. So one thing I'm going to be teaching you right now, money tip of the week, is called Section 75. Does it sound like the most boring lawyer thing I've ever just said? Probably. But what is it, and why do you need to know about it? Section 75 is a rule that is involved with credit cards. When you spend on a credit card anything, and you buy anything between £100 and £30,000, so the item has to cost between that much, but you can put any amount of it on the credit card. So let's say it costs £101, you put £1 on a credit card and £100 on your debit card, it still is kind of covered by this rule, Section 75. Well, if that item comes and it's faulty, or it that retailer goes bust and they never end up sending it to you, or it was a fraudulent website and the product never comes, or the item you're expecting doesn't come as expected, all those kind of, descriptive things, check out the Section 75 rule online to get the actual full description. You call up your credit card company, you tell them what happened, they will refund you, and then they will go and chase up the company to try and get the money back themselves. A really powerful tool, something that's probably worth knowing about, especially if you've got that really big purchase that you want to just be doubly sure comes as expected. It's probably worth putting at least a quid of it on your credit card, just to make sure that you are covered by this Section 75, because it works on credit cards and not on debit cards. Worth noting, by the way, if you are spending anything on a credit card, please, please, please pay it off in full. Otherwise, the interest is not worth it. And that is how people get into severe debt. All right, on that jolly note, stick around, because after this very short break, I have Dr. Dion Terelonge, a fashion psychologist. It's going to be a good one. We'll see you then.
FUBAR Radio.
Making personal finance simpler with Gabriel Nussbaum. This is That Money Show.
Hey everyone, welcome back to That Money Show. For those of you that are just joining us right now, I'm Gabriel, aka That Money Guy. And what we like to do here is make you better with your money. And how are we going to do that exactly right now? Well, I am joined by Dr. Dion Terelonge, fashion psychologist, who is going to be sharing with us all of her knowledge about, well, I guess, psychology, fashion, consumption, and that entire industry. Very relevant to the money in your back pocket. Dr. Dion, welcome to the studio. How are you doing?
I'm okay, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Absolute pleasure. I'm really excited for this conversation, actually, because I don't know if you saw all the articles, was it about last week now, about doom spending and the fact that millennials and Gen Zs are just overspending on things now to make themselves feel better about the fact that there's no prospect in future and anything like that in their life, to put it lightly.
It's just a light casual topic.
Doom spending. The word doom is actually very scary. I think this is going to be a really interesting one. I know that you're called a fashion psychologist, but I'm sure there's a lot of knowledge there about, I suppose, the reasons why people spend so much on clothing in particular. So let's start off with that. What are the kind of psychological drivers behind people's consumption of fashion in the first place?
Just the kind of general drivers, I guess. Well, the number one driver, I guess, is that most people aren't nudists. So they need clothes.
You got me there.
If I'm not so flippant, I guess it's about like social constructs, isn't it? And social expectations. And if we think about clothing, it's such a big part of society. It's a social marker. It tells people perhaps what you do. It tells people what you're interested in. It sometimes can give clues as to your social standing in society as well. So people will often invest quite a great deal in clothing because of the role and its importance in society. And, we always say that clothing is something that speaks of you before you can even open your mouth at times. So I think when people want to think about, feeling good about themselves or making a good first impression or starting a new job, having an interview, anything where they are concerned about impression formation, meaning how other people might see them, then they're going to want to look their best. And the issue we are seeing in modern society is that too often now looking your best and feeling your best is linked to novelty and newness, that we always believe that in order to do that, we have to have something new, brand new for this occasion to get those feelings, which is not the case, you know.
Absolutely.
Nothing in order that make you feel good already, but now it means new things. So we keep buying and consuming.
Got it. And I feel like that's something that can be corrected and fixed, hopefully, for a lot of people to change that link between new meaning, feeling better, constantly striving towards new things. But I would kind of like to rewind for a second and understand more about your job, your career, because I have to be honest, I've heard of psychologists and I've heard of fashion. I've never heard of a fashion psychologist. So this is really, really a cool experience for me myself. What is the day to day or suppose the big picture of the work that you're doing?
I wish there was a standard day to day. So what fashion so is a tricky one, because fashion psychology, or the study of looking at clothing through a psychological lens or even through like a sociological lens, has been around for a long time. Like there were thinkers back in the late 1800s that were looking at the role of clothes and the powers they might have and how, you know, the feeling of an item of clothing, it changed when you owned it and when you put it on the body. So there were people looking at that. But if we think about today, what is a fashion psychologist? It's somebody who looks at fashion in terms of fashion business, in terms of people's consumption habits, in terms of trends, all of that, but through a psychological lens. So what I will do is I will take my psychology knowledge and theories of knowledge, theories of psychology, models of psychology that are typically applied in a more, I would say, typical way, and I'll apply it to clothing. And the reason I do that and how I do that is I am a trained psychologist, like a doctor in psychology, firstly, and in a normal field that you would have heard of. Okay. So I did that. But while I was training, I just thought to myself, it feels so strange that we're always thinking about people and what's going on for them emotionally and how they learn, their relationship with their family, how we can help. But we never think about what they are wearing as they move through the world and the impact of that on your confidence, on your self-esteem, on your perceived readiness. And for me, I felt like we were missing part of the picture, because like we live our lives in clothes and they have such an important role for us. If I went for a job interview tomorrow and I was wearing this my cardigan, my joggers right now, I don't think I'd feel very confident or prepared. But if I put on like a nice like blazer and
get
like
that power suit on,
yeah, then I feel like I've stepped into that person that I want to portray myself as. So I just thought with psychology, we're often missing a trick, and we're looking on the inside, but we're ignoring the outside. So I wanted to bring the two together. And the field has grown. There are more people out there now who are interested in fashion psychology, because there is a course in London that does an undergraduate degree in the area. So it's kind of really breathing life into the field, and more people are becoming interested.
That's brilliant. Well, really well summarized. I feel like I'm up to speed fully now. And that's a really cool career. I love what you were saying about psychology often being seen as internal, always having to like diagnose the unseen. But there's so much that you present yourself as that is still psychology. So really cool. And of course, this is That Money Show. So we do like to look at, I suppose, the links, I suppose, between fashion now and consumption and overconsumption and probably those habits. I'm slightly aware, but you're probably far more aware about how companies and especially the marketing teams within fashion companies potentially prey on consumers when it comes to this idea of, you know, consumption and then overconsumption. What are the tactics they're using that would be really useful for the consumer to be aware of, so they are making decisions for themselves rather than being made the decision for them by the company, by the advert, by the imagery they're being shown?
Wow. Okay. You caught me on a Friday.
Yeah, on a...
My brain's supposed to be winding down. Okay, fine. They have so many tricks and they know what they're doing. And I often wonder if they have psychologists on the inside that are kind of like working for the dark
side. Evil psychologists working on one side and you're the good psychologists working on the other.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Like, how do they know? But basically, you know, there's the common things. It's the false sense of urgency that they love to do. How many times have you looked at a website and like a little a counter saying, 20 people are looking at this item right now.
Oh.
52 people have this in their basket. Why do I need to know that? What are you trying to do there? And what they're trying to do is that drive of urgency. It's that if I don't buy it, they're all going to be gone because look at how many people have it in their basket. But it's a false sense of urgency. I have never heard of an emergency in my life that required you to have that pair of wet look leggings. I don't know what that would be. Why I better get them now. Like, nothing's going to happen if you don't get them. Nothing. Nothing will change in your life. But it does this, and it makes your brain think, oh my gosh, I've only got limited time. And if I don't act now, I'm going to miss out. Without us really engaging our brain and thinking, missing out on what? And what is the consequence of me supposedly missing out? And the answer is often not much. But it really preys on the impulsivity that we sometimes naturally have within ourselves as beings and within the brain. And I think there are many tricks they use. I think, you know, something I've been speaking about in the last week is about kind of familiarity and the familiarity bias. And what brands try to do is they try to put a friendly face to their kind of evil consumption game. And often this comes in the guise of celebrities or reality TV stars. They use to front their campaigns. Mm. People that you think that you know, people that you think have been in your living room because you've seen them on Love Island every night for the past few months, and you know what they like to say and what they like to eat, and they come from a similar place to your great uncle or whatever. So you have this like face. You say, oh, well, you know, Gemma from Love Island's wearing it and she's down to earth and she's my kind of person. So I should wear it too. It's a face that you recognize and that you trust. So it lures you in. But the reality is that she has nothing to do with that brand or in making those items. And it's very unlikely, often, especially when it's fast fashion, that she's wearing those herself.
Yeah.
Because by the time she's come out of Love Island and got those lucrative deals, she can afford better quality clothing that's not synthetic, you know, $9.99 dresses.
Yeah,
so it's a false front that they put into these brands as well that lure people in with that familiarity, the sense of urgency, also discounts.
Yeah, sales. They're really preying on, like, what's it called? Like the animal part of your brain, the part that doesn't think logically and clearly.
Yeah.
And I think the sales is a great one, because one of the tips that I'm often sharing is you often find yourself purchasing things within a sale just because it's on sale. You had no intention of buying it. You're just browsing because things are on sale. And I was like, oh, that, yeah. Whereas I like to tell people, can you switch the narrative? If something's on sale that you've had your eye on for a while, that is what sales are for. That's how you win and take advantage of the sale. If you're buying something because you've seen it on sale, only that, you had no intention prior, well, you've basically just wasted the full amount of money.
Of course you have. You've just lost the money for no reason. But the reason that sales work is because when we think about decision-making, which is a cognitive process, what we like to do as humans is we weigh things up, and we are a lot more sensitive to losing money or losing out than we are to, to gaining. We have this kind of sense of we're always wanting to gain, we're always wanting to win in a situation, to have more than we had before.
Mm.
And it probably goes way back to, like, I don't know, caveman days when you wanted to hoard in case there was like a particularly bitter winter coming and you're trying to get in as much as you can. So I think there's something about that in our brains that tell us to get as much as you can for as little as you can, to kind of bunker down. And sales do that to your brain. They say to you, look, this used to cost £100 and now we're selling it for 20. So there's nothing to lose here. In fact, now you're winning and you're getting more than you had before. It's not the case though, because you are losing. You're losing that £20 that you didn't need to spend because you weren't going to buy that item and you didn't need it in the first place.
Yeah, I suppose it's so hard to just step back and away from it. Like you said, those decisions, they're preying on that quick decision and that response for a reason, because they know they're not giving you the time to think about it. I want to ask you just one final question, which is generally within the world of fashion and what you've learned through psychology and the habits that people are having, what best tips or practices can you give to someone, or would you give to someone sat opposite you right now, when it comes to building the best habits for themselves going forward?
Oh, wow.
These are the big questions. We don't do small questions on this show. It could just be one thing that you wish you could share, even with a younger version of yourself, let's say, that would help someone listening.
Okay. Well, I guess if we think about those biases, I said, that we have in the brain where we don't like to be swindled or to feel that we are losing out or losing money or whatever, if we use that, but we use it to support ourselves rather than to kind of line the pockets of like big companies, then what I would say to them is, if you're shopping next for clothes, and there's a person on Instagram, Andrea Chong, who talks about this, and she's fantastic. But when you're shopping for clothes, look at the label and look at the composition of that garment. And very, very often these days, more so than the 90s, more so than the early 2000s, everything is literally made out of plastic, okay? Or derivatives of plastic. And ask yourself, why would I buy this item for like £70 that is essentially plastic? Because what brands are doing now is they know what they're doing, is that they know people don't understand the quality of a garment anymore, how it should be made, what materials should be made out of. So they're making a killing because they are selling you a high prices and they're giving you poorer quality than they did in the late 90s, mm-hmm. 2000, early 2000s, 70s, 80s, before things were made out of whole materials. Like you might have higher levels of cotton in their wool, in their silks. Now it's plastic. So ask yourself, do I want to walk around a glorified bin bag, which is essentially what it is, because they're made from the same materials. And I think, you know, start to be more discerning and look in those shops and look for items that have more whole natural materials in them. And then you are starting to get a bit more for your money, but that will slow you down in your consumption because, you know, nice. The amount of items that actually don't have that in anymore, but you'll get more quality items. So it's better to have a fewer quality items than a whole wardrobe packed of plastic.
I love that. The double benefit, the slowing you down and the higher quality. Well, Dr. Dion, thank you so much for joining us on That Money Show. And I'm sure that you've given a lot of value to the listener because you've given a lot of value to me. Enjoy the rest of your day. Bye now. Bye. All right, there you go. That was Dr. Dion on all things fashion psychology. Pretty cool. Pretty new one for us here on That Money Show. Scam of the week. The part where we don't scam you, we warn you of scams. Everyone always gets that one wrong, and I've got no idea why. These are the most common scams that happen when people go back to school, back to university, that you need to be aware of. Okay? So we're going to quickly rattle through just a few. One or two. Number one. Textbooks. People love to underspend on textbooks, find the best deals, you know, find everything online. If a deal is too good to be true, please do not go for that. That textbook. And number two, which is a really important one, especially for university students that are looking for accommodation, huge amount of accommodation scams currently on the market where people are urging you to make quick decisions. You know, this place is being looked at by 763 students. If you don't look at it online and send us the money in one day, then you're not going to get it. I understand that it's a very hard market out there right now. Just don't be pressured into making quick, large financial decisions where huge amounts of money are being transferred. There you go. See, told you. We don't scam you. We warn you of scams. So we have some questions. We always like to answer your questions on this show because I feel like that is some of the biggest value that we can give back to you, the listener. And remember, you can always DM us that on @thatmoneyshow on Instagram to ask any question you've ever felt like asking about money, we will answer it live. And Tracy has done exactly that because Tracy has said, I want to buy a flat, but I have no idea where to begin. Is there any steps I need to do before I start looking at places? Well, there's a few common steps between buying any kind of property. Number one is I would recommend getting in touch or being recommended a mortgage broker, a mortgage advisor. Normally, and quite often, these are free. You can find them for free. They get paid by the bank only after they've given you, obviously, their wholehearted recommendation. Now, look for one with a like that's been recommended to you or has a really good reputation, because obviously, if they might try and push you towards a certain product if they're a bad one, but most of them are pretty good. And not only are they brilliant and they will work for you for free for as long as it takes to get your property, they will advise you on everything that you need to know, how much you need, how much you're saving, what information you need to get the mortgage, the best mortgage products on the market, the remortgaging, all that kind of stuff. So these people are absolute heroes. We've actually had a few on the show before. So if you want to listen back to a few previous episodes, that'd be my number one tip. I'm trying to think if anything else is really urgent, but to be honest, the mortgage advisor is something you're going to have to do, and they will give you far more information than I ever could. Question number two, Melanie has asked, my mum doesn't have much of a private pension and spends money like it's going out of fashion. I know she's of the mindset that she's going to work forever and doesn't need to save, but it concerns me that one day she'll have to retire and won't have a lot of money to sustain herself. Any advice? Wow, Melanie, really, you're punching me hard in the face here with that kind of question. Of course, saving towards a pension is super important, and the earlier you can start, the better. And obviously, this isn't the case. Well, it's never the earliest time you can actually start is today. So that's always one piece of advice if she thinks she's too late. Unfortunately, we don't know what the future is going to hold for us in terms of age. A lot of us would love to work forever, but things happen in life, especially towards older age, where you end up requiring more care, more support, which requires more money. And that's exactly what a pension is for. Now, she will get the state pension, which I believe is somewhere in the region of closer to £11,000 a year. But that isn't a huge amount of money to sustain someone. So my recommendation is that at this age, she should be reaching out to a professional, a financial advisor of some way, shape or form, to build a plan specifically for her. She's in quite a unique case where she probably requires quite a large amount of money in quite a short period of time. So that would be the kind of first thing that I would say. But number two would just be to sit down and have that honest and frank conversation that even though she wants to be bringing an income forever, that's not guaranteed, and that burden will ultimately fall on you, her children, to start supporting financially for that. And I'm assuming that will pull on a few of the heartstrings to get started. Like I said, the best time to start was yesterday. The second best time to start is today. And lastly, from Tyler, what do you recommend for young investors to help strike a balance between saving / investing for the future and living for now? I've just left uni and got my first well-paying job. I would like to enjoy that salary as I've worked hard, but also want to start investing early. Thoughts? This is my favorite topic because there are so many. There are two normal schools of thought within personal finance. On the right, you've got the people that say save, invest every penny you can so you can retire by 35. And on the left, you've got the doom spenders, basically. People are like, what's the point in saving? Like, there's nothing to save for. We're never going to hit any of our goals, so we may as well spend everything right now, especially whilst we're young. I'm not even earning enough in the first place to make it worth saving. The truth is, both of those are wrong. The answer is in the middle, okay? So there's a school of thought. Number one, if you're arguing against the person who wants to save everything they have, why does the future version of themselves get to be so happy, but the current version of themselves not get to be happy and utilize that money? Whereas on the left, the spender, is they are literally stealing money from their future. I believe if you look at kind of investing money within the stock market, the earlier you start saving, or the earlier you start putting money towards your pension, or the earlier you start putting money towards that property, the much higher the chances is you're going to hit that really high financial goal. So my advice is build a habit. I don't care if you're putting away £1, £5, £10, £100, £1,000. Start doing something regularly and getting into kind of that feeling of saving in the first place, okay? That's a really good way to just get into the habit. Number two is just review your budget. What are you wasting? What money can you save? And try and stick to that. When that paycheck comes in every single month, save your money before you spend your money, okay? Because ultimately, that means you're paying yourself first before you start paying all these big corporates with that hard-earned paycheck. And it's really a second really good habit to get into. And number three is try and grow that savings pot over time. Throughout your future, you will start to earn more money, hopefully through raises, through getting more experience, all that kind of stuff. And instead of allowing things like lifestyle inflation to happen, which is where you get that £5,000 paycheck and you think you can now put £5,000 more into everything in your life, what you could do is put £100, £200 towards a really nice dinner to celebrate achieving that milestone. But if you can put £4,800 towards your savings, personal finance, you are winning. Tyler, I hope that helps. Anyway, that is it for today. That's all we got time for. Sorry if I didn't get round to your question, but we will try and get round to it next time. And remember, you can always try and get into the queue nice and early right now by DMing us at That Money Show on Instagram to ask us any questions. And remember to follow us for all of the clips from previous episodes. You can also listen back on all good podcasting platforms, or you can catch us live if you download the FUBAR Radio app. I want to say thank you again to all of our guests that joined us today, Dr. Dion, Danielle, and Amy. Once again, I have been That Money Guy. Called Gabriel, but we say That Money Guy. This has been That Money Show, and like promised, you are officially better with your money than you were 1 hour ago. We'll see you next week.